All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable L. Meredith presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you will be heard. God bless the United States and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I am Judge Meredith. I'm joined by Judge Toth to my right and by Judge Jaquith to my left. We are convened today to consider arguments in the matter of Carissa Wiggins versus Todd B. Hunter, Acting Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 244591. Before we begin, I want to acknowledge that the Appellate Project is in the courtroom with us today. This is an organization consisting of law students from the D.C., Virginia, and Maryland area. And so welcome to all of you. Thank you for being here. So with that, will counsel please enter your appearances for the record?
Good morning, Your Honor. Michael Wishney, Veterans Legal Services Clinic, Yale Law School. With me today are two law student interns whose appearances the court has previously approved who will present argument. Romina Lilalari will present the opening, and Gabriella Torres-Lorenzati will present rebuttal. I believe we've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Alexander Yu. With me is Nicole Cottle, and we both represent the Secretary today.
Thank you. So I understand you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so counsel for the petitioners, if you'd like to begin, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Romina Lilalari on behalf of petitioner Carissa Wiggins. I'd like to take some time to introduce our client, Ms. Wiggins, who joins us here today. Ms. Wiggins enlisted in the Air Force when she was 18 years old. Unfortunately, during her time in service, she experienced military sexual trauma, causing her to endure post-traumatic stress disorder and major depressive disorder. When the VA did not accurately assess her service connection and rating for PTSD and major depressive disorder, she timely appealed that decision. Ms. Wiggins filed her appeal on November 29, 2021, and has been waiting for over 3 years for her claim to be processed. This 39-month delay is not only unreasonable based off of the court's track factor analysis, it is also in direct contravention of 38 U.S.C. Section 7112B, which requires that MST claims be expedited for three reasons.
So it's kind of a good point to raise this question. I guess my overarching question is how to fit this into our kind of existing adjudicative framework, right? So you mentioned like track would be one possibility, right? And there's six factors. The other would be, in a sense, a mandamus to kind of enforce a statutory right, which would be the three factors, you know, the lack of alternative adequate means, the clear and undisputed writ. I mean, which framework are you sort of asking us to adjudicate?
The petitioner is asking under the track framework, which is that the VA has unreasonably delayed her appeal decision. Alternatively, or in addition to, she is also asking that this court interpret Section 7112B to require that MST claims also be expedited. And that's for three reasons. The first is that the structure, the context, and the statutory history of the law favors petitioner's plain understanding. The second is that the construction advanced by the secretary would render Section 7112B meaningless, contrary to the Supreme Court's repeated teachings that all words enacted by Congress have meaning. And the third is that the pro-veterans canon directs this court to resolve all ambiguities in petitioner's favor, in favor of Ms. Wiggins. So to go on to the plain meaning analysis, when determining the plain meaning of a law, courts regularly look to the language itself, the specific context in which that language is found, as well as the overall statutory structure. And one key contextual tool that this court in cases like Jackson v. McDonough and the Supreme Court in its 2024 Rudisill decision have relied on is the title and the heading of the provision. And so the title and the heading of Section 7112 is expedited treatment of certain claims. And that's crucial for two reasons. The first is because of the statutory history. when Congress enacted the language of 7112B, the prompt determination and covered case determination language, within that same congressional act, they also amended the title of 7112 from expedited treatment of remanded claims to expedited treatment of certain claims, showing their clear congressional intent to expand the category of cases that would warrant expedited treatment by the board. The second is where Congress chose to enact the language. They chose to do so in a section that has historically been used by both the Secretary and the Board to expedite the treatment of certain claims. And the Secretary makes a number of arguments, one of them being that Section 7112's requirements are triggered when you read it in tandem with 38 U.S.C. Section 7102. But if that were the case, then Congress would have chose to enact this language within that section of 7102. But instead, it chose to do so in the expedited treatment section.
This isn't promptly determining whether an NOD filed with the board is a covered case, a specific type of expedited treatment?
No, for two reasons. The first is that once the board has determined that a case or has promptly determined that a case is a covered one, no consequences from the language of Section 7112 flow from that covered case determination. So in Ms. Wiggins' case, the board decided or the secretary decided that her case was covered in August of 2024, and then nothing happened after that. The second is that the language of 7112 needs to be read in context with the overall statutory structure. And so we know that expedited treatment, as it's used in 7112A, is being meant to refer to expedited adjudication. And the secretary concedes that in their brief. And so reading 7112B to only require a prompt determination would mean that expedited treatment, as it's used in the heading, means something broader, expedited adjudication and prompt determination. But expedited treatment, as it's used in 7112A, would only mean expedited adjudication. And so we know from fixed meaning canons that when Congress uses the same term, expedited treatment, it means the same thing, which is as the board has been expediting remanded claims, it must also do that with covered claims.
What would you make of the fact that, I mean, Section 1166 seems to set out pretty detailed processes for adjudicating the MST cases, but it makes no mention of any timeliness or speed. I mean, what do you make of that?
Two responses to that, Your Honor. The first is that Section 1166 does not actually make reference to a covered case. So it uses words like covered individual or covered determination, covered claims, and it defines those differently from covered cases. So we can't read the covered case language to trigger the requirements of 1166. Those occur regardless of the covered case determination.
But it's clearly describing MST cases, right?
Yes, it's describing all.
Absolutely, those would be the covered cases by 7112.
So the definition of covered case under Section 7112 is a claim concerning military sexual trauma for which the veteran has requested a hearing. The definition of covered claim under Section 1166 is all claims concerning military sexual trauma, which begs the question of why the secretary and the board needs to make a covered case determination and how it is distinguishing between all MST claims and those that have requested a hearing. So those consequences of Section 1166 apply to all MST claims, not just those deemed a covered case. And this is a similar response or similar issue that Section 7102 suffers. So the secretary makes the argument that the plain meaning of Section 7112B appears when you read it in tandem with Section 7102. Section 7102 lays out two requirements. First, that the secretary must provide training or MST-related training to all board members. And second, that all claims dealing with military sexual trauma must be assigned to an MST-trained board member. The problem with that argument is that, number one, the training requirements exist regardless of the covered case determination. That is, all board members must receive this training, and all board members who see cases that deal with MST or that don't will have to have this training. The second, with the assignment requirement, again, is the problem with Section 1166, which is it deals with all MST claims, not just those deemed covered under Section 7112. An easier way of thinking about this is that if Congress were to strike out the language of Section 7112B tomorrow, nothing would happen to Section 7102 or Section 1166. Those processing requirements would still be triggered. Those notification and training requirements would still exist. And so that is the main issue with the Secretary's interpretation.
So I'm going to kind of revisit my earlier question because, you know, I mean, the frameworks are the way courts, I mean, we sort of track frameworks and then we sort of apply, you know, our reasoning onto existing frameworks, you know, so the kind of, I want to focus on the kind of plumbing of this, right? Which is, if I were to, you know, accept your argument that 7112 sort of requires expeditious treatment, what would I be doing with the track factors, right? It would seem to kind of override those. I mean, is this something that, because this, again, is my question about whether you're really seeking mandamus for something, a very specific statutory right that you can show a clear, indisputable right to, or you just want this considered among the other things that we may consider when assessing unreasonable delay. So where and how do we actually apply the statutory analysis?
The statutory analysis is applied independent of the track factor analysis. So we ask that this court read Section 7112B to expedite the treatment.
So that's more of a mandamus, right, which would be the question about whether you can demonstrate a clear – now, I mean, it's okay. It doesn't – I mean, this stuff gets complicated. And we had a recent case called Heller where we sort of combined the two analyses. So, I mean, they're not necessarily mutually exclusive, but – I mean, what you're arguing is really that you have a clear statutory right to expedited treatment, and then we can later to figure out what expedited treatment might actually entail in this situation. But is that, I mean, am I
yes,
characterizing this correctly?
And so the last thing that I'll want to address is the Secretary's argument about the prompt determination language. So they make a number of arguments, the first being that the only thing that a veteran is statutorily entitled to based off of the language of 7112B is just that prompt determination, but they provide no sort of consequences that are triggered after that prompt determination. And so because this court has recognized in cases like Lacey v. Wilkie that we don't read Congress's words to be inoperative or void or meaningless, that interpretation, that very narrow and literalist one, cannot be the plain meaning of Section 7112B alone. The last point that I'll address is so we look from the structure, the context, and the statutory history, and we believe that it favors petitioner's plain meaning of the law. But if the court believes that there's any sort of ambiguities as to what prompt determination means or what expedited treatment means as applied to MST claims, then the last substantive canon is the pro-veterans canon, which directs this court to resolve all ambiguities in favor of the veteran, as the court did in Lacey v. Wilkie when it was unsure about what about the text's consequences for that specific veteran. The pro-veterans canon is a long-standing one. It appreciates the relationship that the government has with its veterans. And as the court has recognized in Procopio, it is also a background norm that we expect Congress legislates behind. And so if there's any sort of ambiguities, then we also ask the court to resolve it in favor of the veteran as well.
I want to get back to the Heller case that Judge Toth just mentioned. In that case, the court found in part that the petitioner had exhausted remedies because he had sought four times for the board to advance his case on the docket, and all four times the board said no without really any explanation. And so the court said there was no likelihood of success on that petitioner having gotten the board on their own to advance the case. Here, back in May 2022, this petitioner did ask the board to advance her case on the docket. And the board basically said, you don't have enough evidence, but if you submit more, we'll reconsider. Has she submitted another request to advance on the docket since May 2022?
No, she has not. The board denied her request because they did not feel that a risk of homelessness amounted to being homeless, and so they denied it for that reason in May. But since then, she has asked her congressman to ask the board to expedite her claim. She has called the BVA helpline to see if there's any updates on her claim, which is laid out in the petition for mandamus, and has not received any sort of updates, which is why we filed the mandamus petition in July.
So speaking of the track factors and what you just mentioned, the evidence that you submitted along with the petition basically covers the period from 2017 to 2022 as to what you just mentioned, risks of homelessness, financial difficulties. Do we have anything in the materials before us as to the current state of affairs, as to the petitioner's situation from 2024 when you filed the petition to now as to those types of concerns?
The mandamus petition, the brief in support of mandamus petition provided some updates on her current financial situation. Ms. Wiggins is in her last year of school, and so we'll be transitioning from being a full-time student to a full-time employee, and will have some financial insecurity as she works to pay off her student loan debt, as well as actively work to pay off overdue bills that she accrued when she was experiencing or at risk of homelessness back in 2022. So we do not have any more up-to-date information in the record right now, but that is her current financial situation.
She's not currently in the hearing lane, is she?
No, she is not. She withdrew from her hearing in April of 2024.
Okay, but that seems to be a something of a prerequisite under 7112B. Am I reading that correctly?
No, Your Honor, for two reasons. The first is that Ms. Wiggins withdrew from her hearing request in April, and the Christopher Santoro Declaration on paragraph 10, which the government cites in their September reply brief, still deemed her case to be covered in August, which was after she withdrew the hearing. The language of 7112B does require that the appellant has requested a hearing, and that condition is satisfied here. Ms. Wiggins has requested a hearing, but because the delay was unbearable for her, she moved to the evidence submission route.
Okay, and I guess just following on Judge Meredith's question, but she's never kind of brought this theory of relief, the theory of why she's entitled to move forward on the docket to VA. I mean, her motion to advance on the docket was based mostly on financial hardship, right?
Yes.
Not on these grounds.
Yes. The mandamus petition is where she believed that Rule 2, Factor 2, which deals with the congressional timetable, would favor in her or would weigh in her favor, given that even though Congress doesn't have a congressional timetable for the board, it did pass this specific act, which shows, regardless of how the court interprets it today, it does show that Congress, one, found the board's treatment of MST claims prior to 2022 to be inadequate, and two, wanted to provide some sort of special consideration to MST claims and MST veterans. Which is when she initially pursued this theory of relief.
So one other factor you cite too in your petition is that the time that the petitioner's appeal has been pending exceeds the average time that is posted on the board's website. Can you explain what significance you're attributing to that statistic? Because given that it's an average or some type of midpoint, we'd expect that some appeals will take longer and some will be shorter. So why is that significant in your view?
Well, it's significant because Ms. Wiggins has exceeded that period of time by over 200 days now. And now the relevant benchmark is no longer 927 days because she's no longer on the hearing route. It is 695 days. And so she is right now at 1,164 days and counting, which is an unreasonable time for her to wait. Although the court does not have a cutoff point of when it finds a specific date to be too long, there are certain considerations, as the court noted in Monk v. Wilkie, a 2019 decision, which it takes into account to determine the rule of reason that justifies the delay. The first is the complexity of the case. And in Ms. Wiggins' claim, her appeal is comparatively straightforward. She alleges two mental health conditions. And what's important here is that the board has not even assigned her case to a VLJ. So her current wait time is 39 months and very well will be exceeding that specific time period, because the 927 days is the average wait time for a case to be appealed, assigned to a judge, and then processed. But the time statistics are important for understanding where you might be relative to the average veteran, but the board or the secretary cannot simply provide an unreasonably long average wait time of 10 or 15 years and then use that as a shield for why its specific delay is unreasonable. So it's an important benchmark, but it's not dispositive for Rule 1 or Factor 1 and Factor 2 of the track factor analysis. If I may briefly just talk about factors 3, 4, and 5, because we didn't get to those. Factor 3 and 5, the secretary and the petitioners are not in much disagreement. The secretary in their reply brief on page 11 concedes that factor 3 does weigh in Ms. Wiggins' favor because this is a matter of human health and welfare. And then on page 14, they concede that factor 5 also weighs in Ms. Wiggins' favor because her interests would be furthered by an expedited time. The only point of disagreement with these two factors is they believe that these considerations apply in all cases of veteran appeals, but that is not a reason to make them any less dispositive. And then very quickly on the fourth factor, I'd like to point the court's attention to the fact that in previous cases, when they've granted a mandamus petition, in Arroyo Figueroa and Mathis, they used published data that the secretary provided of where it was in the queue to see if the veteran was going to jump the line. That data is no longer available. The secretary does not publish it anymore, and so it's very difficult for us to assess whether or not Ms. Wiggins would be line jumping and also where in the queue the secretary or the board is in processing appeals. Thank you.
There's nothing in the legislative history that supports your construction of the statute, is there?
The legislative history is minimal. We know that from one of the bill supporters, Congresswoman Gwen Moore, she believed that this bill, as well as the 18 others that the House passed that week, was meant to improve the appeals process for MST veterans. And so reading Section 7112B in a very narrow way that does not provide any sort of material consequences for the veteran does not improve the appeals process. And although the legislative history is minimal, we know from the statutory history that when Congress changed or enacted the language of 7112B, it also changed the title to expedited treatment of remanded claims to expedited treatment of certain claims. So that suggests or weighs in favor of petitioners' plain understanding of the law.
But Representative Moore was talking about a whole host of changes that included these covered claims cases, the covered case language, the covered claims language. So it wasn't just, it wasn't specific to the language that you're arguing today.
Yes, that's correct. But because we read laws in ways that would further that rather than obstruct Congress's purpose, and we know that this law, as well as the 18 others, were enacted with a broad purpose, the secretary's very, very narrow interpretation of the law would not further that broad purpose. It would obstruct it or provide very little benefits for the MST veteran. Thank you.
For the secretary, you may proceed.
May it please the court. 7112B imposes one requirement on the board to determine if a covered case, if an appeal is a covered case. Contrary to petitioner's interpretation, 7112B does not require that a covered case jump the queue in awaiting adjudication by the board. The court should deny the petition, finding that the board has satisfied the requirements under 7112B and that petitioner has not established unreasonable delay in the adjudication of her appeal. I will be presenting 2 points. First, 7112B only requires that the board determine if an appeal is a covered case, a determination that the board made on August 23rd, 2024. And second, petitioner has not established unreasonable delay in the adjudication of her appeal under the track factors. Turning to that first point, 7112B requires that the board determine if an appeal is a covered case, a determination that the board has already made. In passing Public Law 117-300, part of which is codified at 7112B, Congress addressed concerns that veterans were being re-traumatized during the board adjudication process. Public Law 117-300 requires that the board adjudicate claims involving MST with a greater level of sensitivity. Specifically, the law requires that board members undergo annual MST sensitivity training, that claims involving MST may only be adjudicated by board members who have undergone this training, and requires that VA notice letters and examinations be conducted using trauma-informed language and practices to ensure that veterans are not being, and I quote, re-traumatized through insensitive language. 7112B.
First, if we're going to focus on the specific language of 7112B, how did the board fulfill its statutory obligation under that section to promptly determine Ms. Wiggins' NOD was a covered case when it took two orders by this court to get the determination made 2.5 years after the NOD?
Yes, Your Honor. The Secretary concedes that in this particular case, the board did not make the determination on August 23rd, 2024 promptly as required under the statute. We would note that, however, in this case, that the error here would be harmless in that the determination has been made, and also the concern that 7112B seeks to address, which is to prevent veterans from being re-traumatized during the hearings, will not come to be because petitioner has now withdrawn her hearing request.
What in the record shows that the board made the covered case determination on August 23rd?
Your Honor, in the Secretary's second pleading before this court, in the declaration, the representative from the board indicates that the determination was made, and in the supporting documentation, it notes that the case flow, that the determination was made on August 23rd, 2024.
The pertinent information is blanked out. There's a date, August 23rd date, but it doesn't show what happened.
Your Honor, the date refers to the last entry or event that occurred on relating to a petitioner's appeal, and that was the date that the board made the determination that petitioner does have a covered case in this case, in this event. 7112B.
How can it be true that even if the board did not promptly make the required determination on time, that doesn't support granting the petition? What's the remedy or sanction for noncompliance with the statute?
Your Honor, we would submit that in this case, even though the board made the determination promptly, that the concern that 7112B seeks to address, which is to ensure that veterans are not being re-traumatized during hearing, will not come to be in this case. And that while the board did not make the determination promptly, as it should have, that there is no harm to the petitioner in this case. And that's because 7112B was passed by Congress specifically to address board hearings and to ensure that veterans were not being the one time when veterans would interact directly with the board, to ensure that veterans are not being re-traumatized through insensitive language, and to ensure that the VLJ will conduct the hearing with the requisite level of sensitivity consistent with the MST sensitivity training they're required to undergo.
7112B doesn't say that.
7112B is part of an overall statutory scheme as it relates to adjudicating claims involving MST. 7112B is a part of that. And as I previously alluded to, Public Law 117-300 addresses how the board is required to adjudicate claims involving MST, part of which is to ensure that claims that board members undergo the MST sensitivity training and to ensure that claims are being adjudicated as part only those board members who have undergone the training adjudicate claims involving MST. As part of that overall statutory scheme, 7112B sits before the adjudication process, at the early stages of the adjudication process. And so, as required under 7112B, the board must identify those claims, those appeals with claims involving MST, so that at the hearing, the VLJ will conduct the hearings with the requisite level of sensitivity consistent with their MST training, and to ensure that veterans are not being re-traumatized through the use of insensitive language.
But the language you're talking about is a note after 1166, isn't it?
I'm not sure to what you refer, Your Honor. Could you please clarify?
The language about using trauma-informed language in examinations and hearings and correspondence.
Public Law 117-300 also contains a provision specifying the same.
Yeah, but it's codified. If it's codified at all, it's codified as a note after 1166, not with 7112.
Yes, Your Honor. We would make 2 points here. First, that the public law here is public law 117-300 is the actual law that Congress passed. And so to determine Congress's intent, public law 117 is Congress's is the clearest expression of Congress's intent in passing this law. And so while the note that you're referring to is codified under the USC in 1166, it nonetheless has bearing in that it does demonstrate Congress's intentions in developing the overall statutory scheme in adjudicating claims involving MST.
Further, what are we to make that of the fact that 1166 and that language refers to covered claims and not covered cases?
We would note that the Supreme Court has indicated, the Supreme Court and the Federal Circuit have noted that that the public law such as public law 117-300, again, is the actual law that the Congress passes, and that in any circumstances in which the public law might contradict the United States Code, that the public law would override and be the clearest expression of the court of Congress's intention. The Supreme Court has also noted that the public law is legal evidence of laws. And so again, we would direct the court to that the court can look to public law 117-300 in establishing and determining Congress's intentions of passing not only the overall statutory scheme as it relates to adjudicating claims involving MST, but also 7112B as part of that overall statutory scheme. Indeed.
But doesn't that add fuel to the position that covered claim and covered case must be something different? It's all part of the same statutory pronouncement. If they were supposed to be the same thing, wouldn't they use the same terms?
Your Honor, 1166 governs the AOJ's adjudication of claims involving MST, and 7102 and 7112B govern the board's adjudication of claims involving MST. And so to that, in that respect, there is a possibility why the language is different. We would note that all of these various statutes do combine to establish the overall statutory scheme as it relates to adjudicating claims involving MST. And we would note that throughout the overall statutory scheme, it demonstrates Congress's intent and concern was with ensuring that veterans are not being re-traumatized as part of the adjudication process at all times throughout the process. And the concern was not with the requiring that VA process these claims faster. That the concern has always been and demonstrated not only with the plain language of 7112B and also Congress's intentions in passing public law 117-300 was to ensure that veterans were not being re-traumatized. And as part of that, the board must first identify claims involving MST so that the board will process them with the requisite level of sensitivity.
What about VA's designation of military sexual trauma claims as high priority claims in the appeals manual that was amended even before the statutory change became effective, designating specialized claims processors to ensure high priority and complex processing of claims related to military sexual trauma?
Yes, Your Honor. The Secretary's interpretation is entirely consistent because in identifying claims involving MST as requiring special attention, the statutory scheme as it exists now demonstrates that the Secretary seeks to further that goal. And that is to ensure that when claims involving MST are being processed and adjudicated, both at the AOJ level and at the board level, that VA employees will conduct the processing with the requisite level of sensitivity to ensure that veterans are not being re-traumatized. That the concern was not with the speed at which the claims involving MST was being processed, but to ensure that veterans were provided with the requisite level of sensitivity and care throughout the appeals process.
A priority means more important than other things and needing to be dealt with first. That sounds a lot like expedition, doesn't it?
We would disagree to the second half of your definition of priority here. Priority means that that VA has paid special attention. And when in 1166, it does note that the AOJ is required to create specialized teams which adjudicate claims involving MST. And as part of those requirements under 1166, which are very similar to what was passed under Public Law 117-300, The AOJ is required to identify claims involving MST so that they may be processed by these specialized teams. And in similar manner...
Am I right that, I mean, under 7112B, that VA would at least have a duty to screen the NODs that request a hearing for MST so that they could be promptly evaluated? But there has to be some screening mechanism. Otherwise, I mean, there has to be some attempt to comply with the statute, right?
Yes, Your Honor. The board's current procedures are that before a hearing, an appeal is to be reviewed and the determination of 7112B.
What does that mean, though, before a hearing? I mean, is it 5 minutes before or 3 years before?
The board has existing procedures and processes for processing claims, appeals at which a hearing has been requested. And as part of that procedures, the VLJ reviews case files before the hearing takes place. And they will determine at that point if the appeal includes claims involving MST, so that at the hearing, the VLJ will conduct the hearing with the requisite level of sensitivity.
Okay. And again, I mean, at least at a minimum here, that doesn't appear that that was done, right? I mean, there's no prompt determination as to whether this was a covered claim.
Yes, Your Honor. The Secretary acknowledges that. We would also note that oftentimes the AOJ will have already made the determination that a claim is a covered case, that a claim involves MST. Under 1166, the AOJ is required to identify these claims so that they may be processed in a certain way. When the AOJ identifies claims involving MST, they will mark them with the MST identifier in the AOJ's electronic case management system. Beginning August 22nd, 2024, when one of those claims is appealed to the board, that MST identifier will automatically transfer to the board's electronic case management system.
So that's happened already?
Yes, that procedure was created on August 22nd, 2024. And when one of those appeals...
As a consequence of the court's order?
I believe this was already in process as part of the board's procedure, part of the board's process to comply with Public Law 117-3. Public Law 117-300 was passed in December 2022, and the board is taking multiple efforts to ensure compliance with all requirements under the law, in addition to the new functionalities beginning in August 2024. In April and May of 2024, the board provided for the MST sensitivity training required under Public Law 117-300, and as of today, all VLJs have undergone the necessary training and would be able to adjudicate claims involving MST as part of that process. To return to Judge Cho's questioning, once the AOJ has identified those claims and the MST identifier is transferred to the board, in those circumstances, the board would not be need to make the determination under 7112B again, because those appeals would already be marked with the MST identifier. And the VLJs would know that going into the hearing to conduct the hearings with the requisite level of sensitivity and to comply with the remaining requirements of Public Law 117-300, then the board knows that only VLJs who have undergone the necessary training would be able to adjudicate those claims, those appeals.
So I know your position is you don't believe these are entitled to expeditious treatment. So I acknowledge that, but I'm going to ask this nonetheless. At least in the remand context, we can kind of get a sense of background. What does expeditious treatment actually entail?
When a claim is remanded, they jump to the front of the queue and awaiting re-adjudication.
So basically, you get what would be effectively like a motion to advance on the docket. It's just done sort of automatically.
My understanding is that the functional effect is very similar, in that instead of waiting in the position in which your NOD number would dictate, you would jump to the front of the line with others of similar level of priority, similar level of expeditious treatment.
Okay. And that's and it's generally done pretty consistently across remands.
Yes, as mandated, 7112A has long been interpreted as requiring this particular type of treatment, that remanded claims would jump to the front of the queue, and that we would note that when Congress passed 7112B, it knew that it understood that 7112A and the language contained there required this type of treatment. But when Congress passed 7112B, it chose not to use any of this same language. And as the Secretary noted in its second pleadings, pursuant to the omitted case canon and the meaningful variation canon, Congress's choice to use entirely different language in 7112B is significant and demonstrates Congress's intentions to require something different of the board. Indeed, as this court recognized in Lasker recently, It is significant that Congress chose not to expand the scope of 7112A by simply adding covered case to those which would jump the queue in awaiting adjudication, but rather it created a entirely separate subsection under 7112B. The court in Lasco recognized that when Congress does this, it demonstrates an intention that 7112A and B impose entirely different and distinct requirements on the board.
How do those canons apply if you're relying on the plain meaning, plain language of the statute?
The Secretary submits that the language itself is sufficient, but if the court would require additional interpretive tools, then the omitted case canon and the meaningful variation canon would aid this court in determining that when 7112A has long been interpreted as requiring the type of queue jumping that petitioner is now asking for, when Congress added 7112B and chose not to use the same type of language, that this choice was significant and indicated Congress's intention to do something different. And when viewed throughout the lens of the overall statutory scheme, that something different is to ensure that veterans are not being re-traumatized at hearings. And that first step is for the board to identify those claims before the hearing so that the VLJs will conduct them with the requisite level of sensitivity.
If I turn to the topic other than 7112, have you asked the board lately when they expect to make a decision on the petitioner's claim?
I have asked, Your Honor, and unfortunately the board cannot provide an estimate of the timeline that would take. We would note that as the board is required to adjudicate claims in docket order, but there are other statutory bases for which claims would jump the queue. For example, under 7107B for advancement on the docket, 7112A for remanded claims. And so it is uncertain when a petitioner's appeal will be adjudicated, even though it now awaits in line in docket order, and that line, the size of that line may change based on those other statutory.
So you know generally, you've provided the docket number for the petitioner's appeal in your pleadings. What docket numbers generally are being decided now by the board, and where her number falls in comparison to the groups of appeals they're now deciding?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I don't have that data available.
So how can you assure the court that she isn't suffering unreasonable delay and that her appeal is proceeding in accordance with docket order if you don't know where she is in the line?
We would respond, Your Honor, with 2 points. That first, because petitioner is seeking the writ of mandamus in this case, that she has the burden of establishing the unreasonable delay. And that second, that petitioner's place in the queue, that petitioner has the same place in the queue that in waiting adjudication of her appeal as other veterans would have if they had made the same choices as a veteran. And so there is nothing unusual about petitioner's case other than, and that the delay in this case is due to the size of the docket that petitioner chose when she filed her NOD. When she filed her NOD, she chose the hearing docket, which does have the longest wait times. And unfortunately, given the limited resources of the board, petitioner is required to await her place in line because the board, under statutory section 7107A4, is required to adjudicate appeals in docket order.
But again, I haven't heard anything you've told me that assures me you know that her case is being decided in docket order.
I don't know
what groups of dockets are being decided now or where hers falls in comparison. How do we know it didn't fall through a crack?
Your Honor, the Secretary would point to the declaration from its second submission where the representative for the board again reiterated that as the board is required under 7107A4, her appeal is in place in docket order awaiting adjudication by the VLJ. The Secretary will point out last note on my first point is that if the court were to create a new category of cases which jump the queue and awaiting adjudication by the board, this would harm every other veteran who doesn't have a covered case because they have to wait longer for their board decisions. For every case that jumps the queue and awaiting adjudication by the board, all other cases get pushed further down the queue. Congress did not provide for queue jumping under 7112B. The court should not read into 7112B this provision, absent clear congressional intent, given the harm to all other veterans.
I want to ask you something about your briefing on it doesn't explicitly say it's about the track factors, but it is, I think. And that is that in the Secretary's response to the petition, the secretary characterizes the evidence of the veteran's financial hardship as being of reduced import because all VA's duties involve human health and welfare, and it relies on a 1987 EPA rulemaking case. But that's not the veterans law principle, is it?
Your Honor, the secretary only highlights this point to demonstrate that, well, first we would note that as the court held in Heller, the board's denial of a request to advance on the docket is not a reviewable decision. But in the secretary's pleadings, the secretary is simply referencing that petitioner's situation is not unusual and that other veterans face the same type of financial hardships and that, you know, while we do acknowledge at least some of the track factors do weigh in the petitioner's favor, that the overall analysis, the court should find that there has not been unreasonable delay and that petitioner has not demonstrated so in this case.
But the assertion that that factor is of reduced import is exactly the opposite of what our and the Federal Circuit's analysis of the track factors shows, right? Including Heller. I mean, Heller specifically says that delays that are less tolerable when human health and welfare are at stake, and veterans' disability claims always involve human health and welfare.
Yes, Your Honor, we do acknowledge that, and we simply the only purpose of highlighting this particular point in our prior pleadings is to note that in this case, petitioner did request to advance on the docket, did identify financial hardship as one of the reasons. And we would just simply note that her circumstances are not those which would warrant advance on the docket and in a similar manner do not demonstrate that there's been unreasonable delay in the normal processing of her appeal.
And Heller supports the analysis under that second category, though. It's not just a you can't appeal advancement on the docket motion denial.
Correct, Your Honor. Turning to my second point, petitioner has not established unreasonable delay in the adjudication of her appeal under the track factors. This is not a case of complete inaction by the board. The board, as outlined in the secretary's August 12, 2024 submission in response to the petition, the board does continue to act on the appeal and respond to petitioner's requests. Most recently, in April 18, 2024, petitioner withdrew her request for a hearing, which was acknowledged in the July 24, 2024 board letter. After petitioner withdrew her hearing request, the board provided her with 90 days to submit additional evidence, which is required under the governing regulations. After the 90-day period expired, her appeal was placed on the docket and now awaiting adjudication by the VLJ in docket order. I will note something from the petitioner's previous presentation is that petitioner's appeal does currently await on the hearing docket, but she is now awaiting distribution to a VLJ. So she does remain on the docket that she originally chose. Her request to change the docket was not submitted within the requisite time frame. And so she does remain on the hearing docket, but she is now awaiting distribution to a VLJ for adjudication.
And in neither case, has it been assigned to a VLJ?
Not yet, Your Honor. The delay in this case is due to the size of the docket that petitioner chose and in the NOD. Petitioner is, again, in the same place in the queue awaiting adjudication that other veterans would be had they made the same choices that petitioner made. To address specifically what happened in Heller, we would note that the holding in Heller was based on the track factors and is a case-by-case analysis. And we would submit that the facts of this case are different than what happened in Heller, such that the court should find that petitioner has not demonstrated unreasonable delay. In particular, in Heller, the court, as Judge Meredith noted, the court was particularly concerned with the fact that petitioner had submitted multiple requests to advance on the docket, and the board had failed to provide well-reasoned explanation for its denials of those motions to advance on the docket. And in this case, in the March 2022 request to advance on the docket, petitioner cited financial hardship and severity of her psychiatric disability. But in the May 2022 decision, in the May 2022 denial of that request, the board did provide its reasons for rejecting the request, and petitioner has chosen not to provide the type of information identified by the board in this case. And so we would ask the court to find that petitioner has not established unreasonable delay in the adjudication of her appeal, that petitioner's appeal properly awaits adjudication in docket order as required under 7107, and that the board deny the petition in this case.
I just want to ask you one last question about the statistics that the petitioner relied on, the 927 days, the average time to decide appeal in the hearing docket. What's the significance of that statistic in your view?
That statistic should have no significance, Your Honor. As you pointed out, the nature of an average is that 50% of cases will have longer wait times, while 50% will have shorter wait times. We would note that given the statutory exceptions to the board adjudicating appeals in docket order, there are a number of cases which have much shorter wait times because they are jumped to the front of the queue. We do acknowledge that under the track factors, at some point, a wait can become unreasonable. However, the mere fact that petitioner has waited longer than the average time for her particular docket does not establish unreasonable delay, and we would ask the court to find so.
Is it even a consideration that she's now been waiting at least 7 months longer than the typical case on the board's docket?
Your Honor, we would, again, submit that the very nature of an average is one that it does not apply to every individual case, and that petitioner is a case continues to speak, that she is on the same place in the docket that another veteran would be had they made the same choices. And therefore the averages don't establish that her wait times would become unreasonable.
What happened with this case before August 23rd of 2024?
Could you expand on your question?
Did anything happen from the time the veteran submitted her NOD until it was determined to be a covered case after two court orders requiring that determination to be made?
Yes, Your Honor. So petitioner filed her NOD on November 29, 2021. On November 30th, 2021, the board notified her that her appeal was placed on the hearing docket. In which time she was awaiting distribution to a VLJ to conduct her hearing. She withdrew her hearing in March 2022, which the board acknowledged, in March 2022, she requested to advance on the docket. In May 2022, the board denied that request to advance on the docket. In April 2024, she withdrew her hearing request, and which the board acknowledged in July 2024. While no decision or no hearing was conducted in this case, the board was responding to petitioner's request, and they were processing her appeal as required in docket order. And given the resources available to the board, it resulted in the wait times that she has experienced.
So this is a bit of a housekeeping question, but I think it's worth kind of getting on the record. So one of us is going to have to write this decision, and I think the first thing that a judge will think about is the prospect that, you know, a decision from the board could happen technically any day and just moot out this case. So what I wanted to ask is if you can state on the record that VA's position, at least as a matter of statutory interpretation, likely will not change going forward as to how to read 7112B.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And that this situation may arise in future cases, right? Somebody seeking, so even if Ms. Wiggins gets the relief, she gets a decision, we're mooted out, that somebody in the future may litigate, you know, may seek relief along the same lines. Would you recognize that?
Yes, the Secretary would acknowledge that.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, so this is the type of case that could happen in the future. That would fit into one of the mootness exceptions. It would allow us to write about it at least. I'm not asking you to concede the issue, but just to kind of recognize maybe the predicate facts.
The Secretary does acknowledge that my time has elapsed, and I'll just answer your question. The Secretary does acknowledge that that this issue may come up again.
Yeah, and this is your position. You don't anticipate, yes, you know, a new reading of 7112B in the future.
Correct,
nor that nobody will ever seek relief on these grounds again.
Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Petitioner's counsel, your rebuttal. Please proceed.
Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Gabriella Torres-Lorenzotti for Petitioner Ms. Carissa Wiggins. I would like to begin, if I may, by addressing Your Honor's question regarding the definitions present in Public Law 117-300. Your Honor's correct that there are two different types of definitions. There's a definition for a covered case, and then there's a separate definition for covered claims. And so the Secretary's argument that the consequences that flow from a covered case are these notice requirements, it does not add up. The covered case determination is specifically defined in Section 7112B, and covered claims is a much broader definition than that. So the covered case determination itself is not what triggers the consequences that the Secretary outlined before you today. This is also related to Your Honor's question around what does this prompt determination mean? The order and the command from Congress was that this determination be done promptly. And if the only consequence that flows is a denial notice several years after a notice of disagreement is filed, it would sort of render the command that this determination be done promptly sort of meaningless. And all of these reasons favor petitioner's reading of Section 7112B, which is that the Secretary must make a prompt determination that an MSTP appeal is a covered case for the purposes of expeditious treatment. I would also like to address the Secretary's sort of categorization of what it would actually mean in practice for a case like Ms. Wiggins to be expedited. Our understanding is not that Ms. Wiggins would jump to the front of a queue. Our understanding is that there are two queues. There's an expedited line, and then there's the general docket line. And Ms. Wiggins' appeal would enter the back of the expedited appeals line. It would not jump in front of other expedited appeals as categorized by the Secretary's counsel. I also would like to return to Your Honor's question on, can we sort of decide this issue on the adjudicatory framework of the mandamus without reaching the track factors? And the answer is yes. This court can certainly decide that there's a clear and indisputable right to the writ under Section 7112B and Congress's command that these types of claims be expeditiously adjudicated. In the alternative, this court can also determine that statutory language is important for the track factor analysis and thus find an unreasonable delay.
But doesn't that give meaning to 7112B separate from your argument that it equates to expeditious treatment? If 7112B was intended to connect to expeditious treatment, why didn't it use those words?
Your Honor, because Congress understood that Section 7112 already indicated that those types of claims underneath that section would receive expedited treatment. So when Congress passed Section 7112, it only passed it with A. And then when Congress added 7112B at the very same time, it amended the title to maintain the phrase expedited treatment. And so under the fixed meaning canon of statutory interpretation, we understand that as deliberate choice that Congress made to provide expedited treatment to both remanded claims as well as MST appeals that are deemed covered cases.
Couldn't it also be that the statutory directive to make a prompt determination on whether the case involves military sexual trauma is an indication of the speed with which Congress expects the agency to proceed, the second track factor, such that whether a prompt determination is made could support an unreasonable delay finding, but that doesn't. So that gives meaning to 7112B, but it doesn't cause it to jump into the expeditious treatment queue.
Your Honor, petitioner thinks the strongest reading of the statute is that it does require the expeditious treatment, but in the alternative, if Your Honor were to consider Section 7112B as part of the track factor analysis when considering unreasonable delay, that is another interpretation. But because, you know, of the sort of active decision that Congress made to maintain the title as such, and they knew what Section 7112B with respect to remanded claims entailed, because the board had been expediting those adjudications prior to the amendment of 7112B in December of 2022. And relatedly, even if this court again, doesn't agree with petitioner's plain meaning. At the very minimum, the statute is ambiguous because of the reasons that my colleague shared earlier, which is that the processing consequences that the secretary lays out simply do not add up. There's no consequence that flows from the prompt determination, rendering that provision essentially meaningless. And if this court did find that Section 7112B was ambiguous, the pro-veterans canon instructs this court to find in favor of the veterans at issue in the statute. I also would like to add, earlier we were having a conversation on legislative history and sort of the purpose of the statute. And I would also like to remind the court that in Public Law 117300, the introduction to the act is really quite broad. And that broad purpose is to improve hearings before the board regarding claims related involving military sexual trauma. And Ms. Wiggins is here today because the extended delay in her appeal has certainly not made this a trauma-informed process. It has certainly not made her appeal easier. If anything, it's made it much harder, which is why she reluctantly, removed her request in April of 2024. If there are no other questions, I rest my case. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Petitioner's Counsel and Secretary's Counsel. The case is submitted and will come down.